I came across this television series while I was tooling around on the internet called In Treatment. Apparently, it's this. These episodes feature people who are in therapy and counselors who are meeting with them. And in one particular episode, a counselee is fuming at the counselor. Dr. Paul Weston is the counselor's name, and he says to his counselee, "Is it easier to be angry with me than to look at your own pain? Is it easier to be angry with me than to look at your own pain?" And the answer, not just for television characters, but for most of us, is yes. It's easier to be angry with others than to look at our own pain, to really process what has really happened to us and to feel that pain deeply. It's easier simply to get angry with somebody else, to strike out at somebody else, to lash out. For many of us, that is the path. We're looking at a difficult text this morning, as Steve mentioned, but a very important text. It's the story of Jephthah, and the story of Jephthah is a story of a deeply flawed man. It is also the story of a deeply wounded man. And how he deals with his wounds is in large measure how the story itself plays out. In fact, Jephthah doesn't deal with his wounds at all, and so the story does not end well. And how our stories play out and how our stories end will turn in large measure on how we deal with our wounds. Because we all have them, don't we? No matter how you were raised, no matter what your experience has been in life, we all have wounds, right? We have all suffered emotionally to one degree or another, and we all live with these emotional wounds. So this is an important text for us because all of us, to a certain degree, are like Jephthah and are wounded individuals. When we pick up the story, Jephthah is having this conflict with this pagan king, the king of Ammon, and they are disputing a particular land that is east of the Jordan River. Jephthah has tried to talk and tried to negotiate with the king, but the king is having none of it. The king is dead set on keeping this land that he has stolen from the Israelites, and so it, by all appearances now, it looks like it's going to be war. So we pick up the story in Judges chapter 11, verse 29. In our first section, we're going to go all the way to verse 33. "Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. He crossed Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, 'If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me, when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering.' Then Jephthah went over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into his hands. He devastated 20 towns from Aroer to the vicinity of Minnith as far as Abel-Kiramim. Thus the Lord subdued Ammon." So you can see on the map here where things are taking place. We have Gilead, which is east of the Jordan River, and the battle apparently takes place somewhere in the vicinity of Mizpah, east of the Jordan River, where this land in dispute was located. So the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Jephthah. He seems poised for victory. However, he feels it necessary to make this vow, saying to the Lord, "If you grant me victory in this case, I'm going to offer whatever comes out of my house to you as a whole burnt offering." And a whole burnt offering signified total dedication to the Lord. Now, why doesn't Jephthah do this before the battle? Well, it's because he's not totally dedicated to the Lord. It's if the Lord comes through for him on his terms, then he envisions himself being totally dedicated to the Lord, and he's going to give this thing, whichever comes out of his house, as a whole burnt offering. Which raises the question, what was Jephthah thinking? What was he thinking might come out of his house upon his return? He's hoping to impress the Lord with what he is willing to part with, be it a human that comes out. He's probably hoping some kind of animal comes out, but maybe a human slave or something like that. We don't know exactly what he was expecting, although we do know that he's trying to impress the Lord. He doesn't really trust the Lord to give him victory. He has to prove himself worthy of the Lord in order to be granted victory in this case. That's how he views things. What does the Lord think about this? Well, the Lord is silent in this. The Spirit of the Lord has already come upon him for victory, and he doesn't need to do this vow thing. So the Lord does not endorse this particular vow. What are we to make of vows in general? As you survey the scope of the scriptures, you can see that vows play a prominent place in the Old Testament, but there's almost nothing said about vows in the New Testament. So we have some instances of vows, and they're allowed in the Old Testament, and they are regulated, and so some people will make these vows, and sometimes they will be conditional. If the Lord does this particular thing, then I will do this particular thing. And this particular narrative frowns on the type of vow that Jephthah made. However, it opens the door for other types of vows. So, for example, we might remember the vow of Hannah. So that was viewed in a positive sense by the narrator. But here, the vow is negative. So as we look at all of Scripture, we can't say that the Lord says, hey, never make a vow. I'm not sure that we would want to go that way. However, in light of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ and the ongoing gift of the Holy Spirit, I would say that the path of maturity for the believer in Jesus Christ should take him or her beyond the place where he makes a vow to the Lord saying, I will do this for you, Lord, if you do this for me. So the path of maturity should take us beyond the place where we make a vow. However, I think at the infancy of faith, or before faith happens, I have heard many contemporary stories of people who were not really believing in Jesus, who start believing in Jesus and saying, Lord Jesus, if you do this for me, then I'll do this for you and I'll follow you. For example, I've been to India the last 3 years, and on each of my trips, I have heard stories there from people who came out of Hinduism and began following Jesus based on a vow. They found themselves in dire straits, they prayed to Jesus, and Jesus answered their prayer, and they began following Jesus. For example, there was this one particular church in a Muslim slum, and the man who started this church said it all began when he prayed to Jesus when his son apparently died, and he prayed to Jesus, and Jesus resuscitated his son, and therefore he started a church in a Muslim slum. I preached in that slum. So how can I say, well, that's a wrong thing you did, making a vow like that? He hadn't even started following Jesus, and he makes this vow, and there's this church that has come as a result of it. But as I say, if you've been a believer for a long time or a period of time, it should take you to the place where you're saying, no, I'm not going to go that way. I'm just going to give thanks in view of what God has done for me and follow the Lord wherever he leads. So Jephthah wins this victory. The Lord has empowered him for this victory, vow or no vow. But we ask the question, what will come of Jephthah's vow? Judges chapter 11, verse 34. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines? She was his only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, Oh, my daughter, you have made me miserable and wretched, because I have made a vow to the Lord and I cannot break it. My father, she replied, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me just as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites. But grant me this one request, she said. Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends, because I will never marry. You may go, he said. And he let her go for 2 months. She and the girls went into the hills and wept because she would never marry. After 2 months, she returned to her father, and he did to her as he had vowed, and she was a virgin. From this comes the Israelite custom that each year the young women of Israel go out for 4 days to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite. Wow. Jephthah has painted himself into a corner. He vowed to offer whatever came out of his house on the one hand. On the other hand, the Lord was very strict about forbidding child sacrifice in the law. He said, that's what the pagans do. The pagans sacrifice their children. We don't do that. The people of God honor their children. They do not sacrifice their children. And so he has to make a choice. So the emergence of his daughter from the house represents not his triumph, but his folly. She comes out of the house to celebrate the victory. She's dancing. She's singing. There's music. This is a great celebration as far as she is concerned because there's been this great victory. But actually now it represents the folly of her father. And notice what her father says to her. You have made me miserable and wretched. Look, the father is the victim in this, right? That's the way he's wording it. It's all about how he feels. He's made this vow to her detriment, And now he's thinking about how he feels. Oh, I feel so bad. It's not about you, it's about me. You have made me miserable and wretched. So now Jephthah has a choice. What's he going to do? Presumably, he could have gone with the lesser of two evils. It's sin to go back on a vow, but it seems to be a bigger sin to sacrifice your child. But on the other hand, we remember that Jephthah extracted a vow from the Gileadites. When all this thing was first beginning, when the Gileadites first asked Jephthah to be their head, he extracted a vow from them. He made them vow to the Lord that, yes, indeed, he will be their head. So now to go back on his own vow would be to lose face before the Gileadites. So again, he has painted himself into a corner. Now the daughter is a virgin. She is his only child. And this makes it all the more tragic because that means if she dies, Jephthah's line dies with her. She says, "Let me go out and weep with my friends." Immediately, she came out of the house and she was dancing, right? Now the dancing turns into weeping. She goes off into the hills to weep with her friends. When she returns, the text tells us that Jephthah did as he had vowed. Did what? The narrator spares us the details, but it seems pretty clear. He offered her up as a whole burnt offering. He sacrificed his daughter. He killed her. He burned her. This is awful. This is absolutely horrible. And that's what the narrator would have us believe. Jephthah sacrifices his daughter on the altar of his own ambitions. He wanted victory so desperately, and he ends up sacrificing his daughter for it. And we wonder, if he is willing to sacrifice his daughter, what else is this man willing to sacrifice? Some of us view God as the great withholder. We think that he really doesn't want to give us what we want, what we need, and we think perhaps that we have to impress him, we have to prove ourselves to him, we have to prove ourselves to him with what we are willing to part with so that he might give us what we want. We don't go to Jephthah's extremes, obviously, but some of us live Jephthah-like lives, not really trusting God, not really believing God, not really believing that he knows what's best for us, and therefore we try to prove ourselves worthy to him in one way or another. When we do that, however, we tend not to impress God, but to harm those who are closest to us. Because all we're thinking about is ourselves, just like Jephthah. All we're thinking about is, hey, what I need, what am I going to get from God? What do I have to do to get from God what I need? And these other people who are closest to us, they take a back seat, and oftentimes we hurt them in the process. Some people who feel called by God and that God has this great thing for them to do, sublimate their obligations as husbands, as wives, as parents, to this supposedly greater call to serve God. And this hits me very closely because I'm doing the Lord's work, right? Now, in a biblical sense, we are all, of course, doing the Lord's work, but when you are studying the Scriptures and preaching and teaching and sharing Christ, you really kind of feel this pretty personally, that God is really working here and you have this great job to do in the world. Now, it can be easy then to forget about your family, which is one of the reasons I'm thankful that here at PBC, then when we are reviewed as pastors and as elders, we are reviewed in this order: your relationship with the Lord, your relationship with your family, and ministry, third. Ministry comes third. What God is calling you to do in this world takes third place. Your relationship with Him comes first, and then your immediate ministry is to your family. So I have to write up something every 2 years, and I find this to be very helpful, a helpful reminder, and that I am reviewed on that basis. For some people who sublimate these so-called minor tasks to the greater task of serving God in the world, we are left to wonder, are they really giving themselves to the Lord, or are they giving themselves to their own ambitions? For some of them, perhaps their greatest victories might be their greatest folly. And some will even play the victim, like Jephthah, and they will blame others, wives, husbands, children, for getting in the way of their dreams. They've got these big things they're supposed to do for God, and all these little things are getting in the way, and they will play the victim and blame others for getting in the way, just like Jephthah did. He blamed his daughter, essentially, for getting in the way of his big dream of victory. Sometimes the people who come off as the most spiritual do the most damage. So now in our story, we transition from the enemy without Ammon to the enemy within Ephraim. And that's where Jephthah has to turn his attention now in Judges chapter 12, verses 1 to 7. Then the men of Ephraim called out their forces, crossed over to Zaphon, and said to Jephthah, "Why did you go fight the Ammonites without calling us to go with you? We're going to burn down your house over your head." Not a very mature response. Jephthah answered, "I and my people were engaged in a great struggle with the Ammonites, and although I called, you didn't save me out of their hands. When I saw that you wouldn't help, I took my life in my hands and crossed over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave me the victory over them. Now why have you come up today to fight me?" Jephthah then called together the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. The Gileadites struck them down because the Ephraimites had said, "You Gileadites are renegades from Ephraim and Manasseh." The Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan leading to Ephraim, and whenever a survivor of Ephraim said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead asked him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" If he replied, "No," they said, "All right, say Shibboleth." If he said Sibboleth, with a different pronunciation because he could not pronounce the word correctly, they seized him and killed him at the fords of the Jordan. 42,000 Ephraimites were killed at that time. Jephthah led Israel 6 years, then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in the town of Gilead. So we see our map again here, and we see that Ephraim is a tribe in Israel that is west of the Jordan, Gilead is east of the Jordan, and there is this uneasy relationship between the east and west in Israel at this particular time. And then there is this battle that ensues between Gilead and Ephraim. So Ephraim feels insulted. "You went to war against the pagans and you didn't invite us. You didn't call us. You didn't invite us to the party. You left us out." And Jephthah said, "No, that's not actually the truth. I did invite you, but you didn't come." So what's the truth? It's very difficult to discern what the truth is here. Who's at fault for not inviting whom or whatever? Did you get the invitation and you just didn't? It was in the mail, you know, but I forgot to check my mail. It was in the inbox, but it went to the wrong box or something. We don't know all of that what happened. But at any rate, there's this dispute between the two of them. Now here Jephthah shows less patience with his fellow Israelites than he did with the Ammonites earlier. And he takes the fight directly to them. He doesn't even wait for them to answer him. He takes the fight directly to the Ephraimites. And then the battle ensues, and then the stragglers from Ephraim are at the fords of the Jordan River, and then they are given the opportunity to pronounce this one particular word, and they can't pronounce it right. So they are, perhaps their accents are different, we don't know exactly what, but the Ephraimites pronounce this one particular word different than the Gileadites, and that's how the Gileadites were able to identify them. And once they came out as a Ephraimite, then they were slaughtered at the fords of the Jordan River. And so we can see, we don't know exactly what that spot is, but someplace along the Jordan River there, between Gilead and Ephraim, is where the Ephraimites met their demise. So why did Jephthah just, why does he show no patience with these people? They're his fellow Israelites. Why does he take the fight immediately to them? There is this accusation that is made against him and his fellow Gileadites that I think explains everything. And it's this. This is the accusation. "You Gileadites are renegades from Ephraim and Manasseh." You Gileadites are renegades from Ephraim and Manasseh. And with that one sentence, his whole world goes back to where it all began. Because Jephthah was a renegade from the beginning. He was born of a prostitute. His half-brothers drove him out of town, and they forced him into the life of what? A renegade. He became a renegade. And so we can imagine that these aspersions have been cast his way his entire life. "You renegade, you renegade, you a deserter." All sorts of things were leveled against him. All sorts of accusations we can imagine were leveled against him. So when this one particular accusation comes back to haunt him, he snaps. It goes to a very deep place in him. And so he has to take up the sword at this point. He's a renegade. He's been called a renegade. Jephthah sacrificed his daughter at the altar of his ambitions, and now he slaughters 42,000 Ephraimites, fellow Israelites, for a personal slight. Personal ambition on the one hand, a personal slight on the other. And the story of Jephthah comes full circle, but not in a positive way. Because remember, at the first he was forced into the life of a renegade, and now he kills 42,000 Israelites for being called a renegade. Why does Jephthah make this vow, this ill-advised and unnecessary vow? Why does he kill his daughter? Why does he slay 42,000 Israelites? Now, motivations can be very difficult to discern, but from one angle we can say this. He did all of these things, he wreaked all of this havoc because he was a wounded man, because he was driven from his home, because he was wounded, and because he never recovered from that wound. And he saw himself as a victim his whole life long. And that particular wound took over his life. It controlled everything. He viewed everything in life through the lens of that particular wound, and he bled all over everyone around him. This is how it works in life, doesn't it? The wounded becomes the wounder. The abused becomes the abuser. It's not usually the star quarterback who arms himself with semi-automatic weapons and goes into the school cafeteria and turns it into a bloody mess. No. It's not the star who does that, it's the outcast. It's the outcast who has been deeply wounded, who has been scarred, who has been hurt, who has been pushed to the margins, and he's going to get back at the world, and he's going to open fire. The latest example of this, of course, took place at Oikos University in Oakland a few weeks ago. How does it work? We're wounded, we have these pains in life, we have emotional scars, but we don't want to deal with it. It hurts too much. So what do? We deflect that pain, and we deflect that pain onto others so that others then bear the brunt of the wounds that we have experienced. We deflect our pain. It is easier to get angry with someone else than to look at your own pain. It is not true that time heals all wounds. It is what you do in time that matters, right? Time does not heal all wounds. What you do with time and in time is the thing that makes the difference. So what should we do with the time that we have, with the time that we have today? Much can and should be said, but for now, consider the story of a woman. She, like Jephthah, was an outcast. She was relegated to the margins of her society, driven from home. She was considered unfit for normal social intercourse. In fact, anybody she touched became also unfit, at least temporarily, so she hid in the shadows. And she didn't really come out very often. She had to skirt around things and skirt around people. When people looked around for her, it was to avoid her, not to see her, not to make contact with her. She heard, however, one day, that a man with healing powers was coming to town, and there was this big crowd around him. And she thought to herself, if somehow I manage to fight through the crowd and I just reach out and I touch a piece of his clothes, that's going to bring me healing. That's what she thought. And that's what she did. She managed to fight her way through this crowd, and she managed to touch just ever so briefly this man's clothes. And then she ran because she didn't want to be seen. Then she skirted away again to recede into the shadows. But she felt that she had been healed. Nevertheless, she ran away. What did Jesus do? He stopped. This is the story of Jesus and the bleeding woman, obviously. You find it in Mark chapter 5, 25 to 34. He stopped. He was on an urgent mission to heal somebody else, but he stopped the ambulance in order to deal with this particular woman who touched him because he felt that power had gone from him. And then what happens? The woman comes forward. The woman emerges from the shadows. For the first time in her life, she emerges from the shadows. And what, for the first time in 12 years, I should say, because she had this bleeding condition for 12 years. She emerges from the shadows, and she tells Jesus the whole truth. She tells Jesus everything. She opens her heart. She unburdens herself before the one who has brought her healing. What does Jesus do? He says, daughter, your faith has made you well. He calls her daughter. That's an inclusive term, a daughter of the kingdom, a daughter who belongs. And he talks about her faith, not her filth. Here's a woman who felt filthy, and now Jesus is extolling her faith. Your faith has saved you. And how does he bring about this whole healing? He does it in the context of this crowd. The crowd is there to witness the whole thing. The crowd which has excluded her. And Jesus bids her peace. Go in peace. What's he doing? He's restoring her to this community. He's saying, you belong to God, and you belong to God's people. He restores her. What do we learn from the woman as opposed to what we learn from Jephthah? Number one, come to Jesus. Pretty simple. On the one hand, on the other hand, a little bit scary on the other, because this woman really didn't want to come. She worked up the courage to come, and even after she did come, she skirted away. She withdrew. Why? She's worried about being found out. She's worried about being disappointed. She had already spent all she had on physicians who weren't able to help her, but actually made her worse. So it takes courage. You have to trust. You have to really reach out to Jesus in a way that says, here I am, Jesus, and here's what my problem is. Can you help? Come to Jesus. Jesus, he is the one necessary thing. The book of Judges pushes beyond itself, pushes beyond David, pushes beyond Jephthah, then beyond David, and pushes us all the way until we get the New Testament, until we get to Jesus, who is the answer to the problem. And Jesus stopped this woman's flow of blood. What about him? The upper room, he said, this blood is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. And on the cross, what happens? The blood flows. Presumably, he could have stopped it somehow. Presumably, he could have not even gone to the cross. But instead of stopping the flow of blood, he lets the blood flow. Why? So that we could all be healed. Not just one woman who touches the fringe of his garment, but so that we can all be healed. So that we could all come to Jesus and be healed. Come to Jesus. Number two, tell him everything. That's what the woman did. Tell him everything. Go as deep as you can and as far back as you must and tell Jesus everything. Open your heart to Jesus. Don't hold anything back. Give him everything. It may be helpful for this particular exercise to get a pencil or a pen and paper and just write. Because when you write down words, words unlock feelings. Tell Jesus what you actually feel and think, not what you think you're supposed to feel and think. Give him everything. Tell him everything. What happens when you do that? The whole ugly truth? You think he's going to run away? No, what does he do? He calls you daughter. He calls you son. This is what I want. This is the reality that I want. Not that fake, distant relationship that you think I want. I want this. I want the real stuff. I want you to really to go deep. I really want you to tell me your wounds. I really want me to tell you all the stuff that you've been dealing with. Give it to me. You're my daughter. You're my son. And what does he see? All that filth that you just dragged out? No, he sees your faith. That's faith. Come into Jesus, just like the woman did. Tell him everything. He says, you're a daughter, you're a son, you belong. Now, the first time that I did this, coming to Jesus with this intention to tell Jesus everything, was probably about 17 years ago, I'm guessing. And I had the sense that there were some wounds from my past that were controlling my present. I couldn't really understand all of this. I just had this sense, and I had this sense that I had to come to Jesus, and I had to deal with this. So I went on my first ever spiritual retreat all by myself, and I spent 2 days with the Lord, and mostly what I did is I got out lots of paper, and I brought with me a pen, and I wrote thoughts, I wrote feelings, especially memories that came to mind. And I just wanted to let it all go and bring it before the Lord and say, okay, Lord, this is what happened, this is what I felt, this is what I feel now, what do you think? And at one particular time, a painful memory surfaced as I was writing, and this is a memory that I don't ever remembering, really. It just sort of resurfaced. And if I were to tell you what it was, you wouldn't think, oh, that's not that big a deal. And probably it wasn't that big a deal, but it was sort of emblematic of the wounds I had suffered in life as a child. Sort of emblematic. And so I wrote that down, that thing that happened. And at that particular point, I stood up and I pointed at what I had written and I said, that shouldn't have happened. Wasn't that bad, but still, it shouldn't have happened. God didn't make this world full of death and anger and sin and wounds. That's not the way He made the world. Sin has entered into the world this way. And so I'm able to say then, that shouldn't have happened. In God's world, that shouldn't have happened. But it did happen. But I'm not saying what I'm supposed to say. I'm saying what I actually think and feel. So I wrote that down. That wasn't supposed to happen. And as I stood up and as I walked around, I felt something that I think was coming from the Lord that went something like this. Yeah, I know. I know that shouldn't have happened. But you know what? I was there. I was there. Long before I came to know Jesus. What was the Lord doing? I'm pretty sure what He was doing is saying, I was there for all that stuff. I was there present, love. I wasn't away. I was there present, actively working, even before you came to know me, actively working to overturn all of this stuff, to turn ashes into beauty. In my beautiful sovereignty, He was working to turn it all into something that was good and beautiful. Not to stop the wound from happening in the first place, but to turn it into something beautiful, to transform it. In view of what Jesus Christ has done for us in His death and His resurrection, we, of course, do not have to sacrifice our children like Jephthah did. What instead do? We offer up our bodies. We sacrifice our bodies as living sacrifices. We give ourselves to the Lord as living sacrifices. We offer to Him our entire lives. Romans chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Also, based on what Christ has done for us, we do not need to prove ourselves to God or impress Him in order to extract from Him that which we want. Why? Jesus tells us, Matthew chapter 6, verse 8, your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. Isn't that beautiful? Your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. Come to Jesus. Tell Him everything. He heals you. Or, more likely, He begins to heal you. Because if you came to Jesus one time and He healed you completely, you would probably say, thank you very much, and be on your way, and never to see Him again. So that's why, for most of us, this is an ongoing process in which we return to Jesus again and again and again. And we sense His love, we open up to Him, we touch Him, we tell Him everything again and again, and He continues to heal us with His healing love. Sandra Wilson, in her book, Hurt People, Hurt People, writes this. All of us must answer this question, important question. Will we continue to run the assigned laps in a wretched relay of intergenerational pain, that ongoing cycle of hurting, hating, and hurting again? Or will we stop running, break the cycle, and start a new cycle of healing and helping? Jephthah ran the wretched race of intergenerational pain. Jesus, however, shows us a different way. He ran a different kind of race. He didn't deflect the pain onto others. What did He do? He absorbed the pain. It died with Him. He goes to the cross. Think about this. He is the only sinless man, and He suffers for the sins of the entire world. And there on the cross, He is being abused mercilessly by the people who have put Him on the cross. And what does He do? He just hangs there. He doesn't strike back. In fact, He offers blessing for curse. And He says, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Hearkening back to our series of the seven last words of Christ before Easter. It's part of our Lent series. So all of that pain, think about this, all the pain he suffered, all that emotional pain from taking on the sins of the world, what does it do? He doesn't deflect it onto others. It dies with him. Dies right there on the cross. He is not going to perpetuate it. He is not going to run the wretched race. He is not going to hand the baton of pain off to somebody else. It dies with him. What does he do for us? As we come to him, as he begins to heal us, he converts wounds into ministry. Every wound conceals a ministry. And you know this, don't you? I mean, you know this from the way that you've lived, from the pain that you've experienced. What does that do? As you bring that to Jesus, Jesus gives you a compassion for others who have suffered likewise. And you see this all over the world, of people who have suffered, but they have found something for their pain in Jesus, and then they say, ah, I want to help others. So Jesus nurses us, but then he also sends us out. The place where you hurt the most then, brothers and sisters, may be the place where you have the most to offer. The place where you hurt the most may be the place that you have the most to offer. For the church, after all, is not a hospital. Spiritually speaking, it's a military outpost with an infirmary. Spiritually speaking, it's a military outpost. Here we are, sent out into the world with an infirmary, because we're wounded people. So we got to get healed. We got to come to Jesus. We got to come to each other. We got to be the hands and feet of Jesus for each other. And we have to receive healing from Jesus through each other. But then Jesus sends us out in the world too, because the world is full of wounded people just like us who need the healing touch of Jesus. And how are they going to get it if they don't get it from us? Jephthah saw himself as a victim, and he deflected his pain onto others. Jesus, on the other hand, heals us and sends us out into the world to bless even those who wound us in the amazing virtue and power of the gospel. Are you running the wretched race of intergenerational pain? Are you just taking that baton of pain and passing it on to somebody else? Are you deflecting that pain that you've experienced onto somebody else? Come to Jesus. Touch him. Tell him everything. Amen.